Welcome to a podcast that will change your life. This is Radio Free Nintendo, and it is the first day of the rest of your life, known to those of you who aren't listening, as July 7th, 2016. I am your host, James Jones. With me today is the esteemed luminaries, Mr. John Lindemann.
James, we all look to you for inspiration.
That's a sound decision, if I say so myself. Mr. Greg Leahy.
I'm just bewildered. I can't even do the Burns quote.
And unfortunately, we were unable to be joined by the esteemed luminary of French-Canadian culture, Mr. Guillaume Veillette. But
Sacre bleu.
We are thrilled beyond description to be joined by our friend, the profound Mr. Michael T.Y.P. Cole.
Exactly.
And this... This is the first podcast of the rest of your life. Episode 484 of Radio Free Nintendo. And if you're still listening at this point, I could intro this show any way I wanted. And you'd probably just suffer through it. Because at some point, this is going to be like me playing wrestling music to intro people. And you're going to go, oh, yeah, James has just lost his mind. Who cares?
I would say that it's all downhill from here, but it's actually not true. This is probably the bottoming out of the rest of your life.
I may have spent an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out which Junkyard Dog intro theme best fit John Lindemann, but
guys, this is what happens when you spend like an hour talking about another Monster Hunter game.
I just didn't have the time.
Just grab them cakes, and we'll call it a day.
All right, but that's enough talking about the future. Your future and mine. Instead, we're going to talk about, the past as of between now and last week when we played video games. We did. And Greg, what video games have you been playing?
Well, yeah, so this week I'm going to talk about Poker Tournament. I talked about playing the demo a while ago. I did eventually get the retail copy of the game. And, playing the demo is kind of... just sort of messed around, you know, stuff happened, flashy, arcadey things hit the screen. And, you know, it looked pretty and it seemed fun, but didn't really get too much of an idea of the game itself. Whereas once you actually get the retail game, there's quite a extended tutorial, like three-phase tutorial on how the game actually works, because there's a little bit more to describe than just a sort of one-on-one fighting game you might expect, especially because it's got this whole two-phase thing. So you've got the kind of three-dimensional field phase of the battle where you can move around your opponent, you know, on multiple axes, whereas then you've got, but under certain conditions, it then collapses down into the kind of the dual phase where it's just like a side-scrolling fighting game. So once you get into the tutorial, you actually deal with all those things. You also deal with the fact that there's an attack sort of triangle, much like sort of you've seen in other kind of 3D fighting games where you've got kind of, you know, grabs beating blocks and counters beating regular attacks and regular attacks beating grabs. So, you know, that makes sense in a Pokemon-inspired game, considering that's kind of, you know, always you have the little rock, paper, scissors kind of element to the three starters and all that kind of stuff. And it's something that's been in other games of this type. So between, you know, all those different facets, all that, I had a much better grasp of, you know, what the game was going to be like. And then I started working my way through the one-player game, which is, you know, nothing much to it so far. You basically just sort of advance up the ranks of different leagues by playing a few matches. So you play like a set of five. If you win most of them, you actually advance up the league, and then if you advance far enough, you go into a little tournament at the end, and then if you win the league, you get to play a match against the sort of the master of that league to be promoted to the next one. So just involves playing a lot of matches in a row, basically. And I got promoted up a couple of leagues and probably fought about 50 times before I actually lost. You know, it feels like it's a little bit slow to ramp up that stuff because, you know, like I said, you know, you get the tutorial takes you through the sort of basic mechanics, but I don't really feel like the actual, and also could take you through some more advanced stuff if you want, but it doesn't really feel like the actual challenges of the single player really putting me to the test on my knowledge of those yet, and that's reinforced by when I've just tried it out online. Obviously, always a bit dicey when you come into an online game late.
Yep.
But
it's either dead or you are dead.
Yeah, and it's very much the latter in this case. So, you know, I mean, it is. Just bear in mind, I wasn't foolish enough to try the rank battles. That was clearly just be doomed to fail. But I thought, yeah, let's try the friendly sort of one, the ones that are just the equivalent of for fun against anyone. And I managed to win about one battle in the first 15 I played or something. I mean, it's tough. And you're seeing the stats, of course, you know, they fought many, many, many times and they're, you know, solidly over 50%. Usually I don't know how much of a failure that is of matchmaking or just those are the people that are still on there. Again, the late issue is kind of comes into play there. But yeah, that very much demonstrates the limits of my understanding of the different components of the game, because yeah, I've been absolutely getting roasted online whenever I've dared to try it. I think I'll have to get a fair bit better before I go back to that. But I can say performance wise it's pretty encouraging. I mean, you could see there's a little bit of a distance aspect in terms of it shows the location of people you get matched up with, and all the ones I've had against people in European locations have been pretty tight. And then I've had, you know, a surprisingly sort of tight one with somebody in Canada and all this kind of stuff, but the only ones that have been a bit iffy were ones in the US, you know, far away. So it definitely holds up really well, though, for the most part, and I would assume, especially if you're playing at busier times, you're probably more likely to get people who are closer to you. And you know, obviously it's essential for this kind of game that it holds up well, and it does. So it could be fun if I ever actually get any good at it, but that's debatable, to say the least.
You know, I have very little experience with these sorts of online games, but it seems like when you're going in that late and there's such a big gap, it's like I can't tell whether I fundamentally don't understand how to play, or it's just the level at which I'm playing just isn't there, you know? Is there something fundamental I'm totally missing? Or is it that just, well, I just haven't put a lot of practice, I don't understand the nuances of this and that? I mean, because something like Smash Bros., I feel like, well, I'm an okay player. I understand the basics. I don't study what exactly beats what for every character, and I haven't studied, you know, all the intricacies that when you... It's very similar. I went back and played Smash Brothers not too long ago online just for kicks. It's like, oh, okay, yeah. Well, you know, I'm losing, you know, maybe win one out of every 50 matches, you know. It's like...
Oh, jeez.
And I'm not terrible at the game. I'm just not great at it, you know, so... I have a lot of trouble with these kind of games.
It's an issue.
It's so demoralizing.
It is an issue. So, I mean, with this, I kind of bought it mostly, you know, to play with a friend locally, because, you know, just to, you know, enjoy Pokemon, you know, silly attacks, kind of have fun with it, kind of thing. Because I'm not a very good fighting game player. I went through about a decade-long stretch where the only fighting game I played for any significant length of time was Smash Brothers. But, you know, I mean, when you had the sort of renaissance of fighting games in the, you know, the sort of last generation, you know, Street Fighter came back, Mortal Kombat came back, you had Tatsunoko versus Capcom, and, you know, Marvel versus Capcom 3 and all this, you know, it did come back in a pretty big way, and I've enjoyed playing those games, you know, just somewhat casually. You know, I don't have to get all the way into it and be playing online regularly to get my money's worth out of those, and that's very much what you're dealing with here, because I don't think I'm going to be able to master all the sort of intricacies of it my myself, but you could still appreciate the ideas in it. I mean, the whole thing about switching the phases is interesting, and definitely going online shows you how differently like intelligent human players use that versus the AI. Because yep. when you're in the field phase where it's open, that is the one that tends to be shorter lived, because just a few attacks in succession will kind of thrust you back into the duel phase. Whereas with the duel phase, it's kind of you could take quite a bit of punishment before it would switch, but you can kind of switch it at your discretion by initiating a grab move. If you grab somebody, you will then force it back into the open of the field. And that's the thing, there's some entertaining kind of possibilities there, because a lot of the matches hinge around building up the synergy gauge, which is essentially a super move gauge, where a lot of the Pokemon just turn into their mega evolutions, and then you've got a kind of super move even within your sort of charged up state, which does ridiculous damage and is ridiculously flashy and just plain weird, like Chandelure sneaking behind someone in a mansion, Gengar doing some kind of like space time swallowing thing. It is crazy. They're just fun to look at, but you know, those do a lot of damage and they can turn a match. But the interesting thing is that, you know, those are a lot harder to kind of land when you're out in the open. You know, you've got a hell of a lot more space in the field phase to avoid attacks like that, and kind of, so sometimes it could be, if somebody initiates their kind of boosted up state with the full synergy gauge, it can be worth taking the risk to just run right up to them and grab them to force it out into the open, and then play keep away and let them waste it essentially for the rest of the time. You know, things like this is that, you know, I'm nowhere near mastering it, but it's still, you know, offers something that, you know, I haven't really seen in another fighting game. So I'm not very very knowledgeable about all different fighting games, especially the 3D ones, which I haven't played a great deal of. Though I did have Tekken Tag Tournament 2, again, just to sort of revel in its silliness, which is plentiful, as I know you know, James.
Yes. So, I'm curious. I mean, obviously they have shared lineage too.
Yes, indeed they do.
I'm curious, you know, having seen online players play the game in a distinctly human way, do you find that you're translating your observations into actual learnings, as it were?
Well, I think it's helped me to like go back into the kind of the single player mode and play that better, even though I wasn't really having too much trouble with it anyway. But what it hasn't really done to this point is produce a sort of appreciably better results against human players.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest problem I've got right now is not so much just the kind of broad strokes, but really comboing techniques together. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not mega complicated. You've got kind of a quick attack, a stronger attack, and then a special attack, which revolves around sort of Pokemon star moves. So like Sceptile, who I've used a lot, has got a kind of a Leetsy type of move that goes along the ground and things like, you know, that everyone will have assigned to A, their kind of special Pokemon techniques. And then you've got the other ones, which are more kind of punch and kick type of things. And then in the field phase, you're so the X button, your kind of strong attack becomes a homing attack. So that's basically how you close the gap between you and the player while using that. And it can be an interesting sort of thing there, because sometimes when I've played human players as well, what they've done, if they've got a character that's good with distance attacks, they seem to be more prone to stay in the field phase and just kind of chip away at me, which is not something that I've ever seen the single player AI do. You know, like the single player just kind of is quite passive in the field phase a lot of the time. So it's more on you to take the initiative and put it into the duel phase. But yeah, that's really it, I think, is kind of, because you can go into there are advanced tutorials to kind of cover, you know, comboing with certain specific characters and all that. And that's where I'm definitely deficient at the moment. I don't know whether it would really benefit from that, to putting time into that.
Yeah.
I mean,
and you don't know what human players are going to use against you until you go out there and they use it against you and kick your ass.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Are the input strings character specific? for the combos?
Oh, there's a certain amount of... Obviously, there are certain things that are common to all the characters. Like, for instance, you know, counters are, you know, one pair of buttons. Grabs are another pair of buttons. Using the shoulder button to call in a support Pokemon. Using both shoulder buttons simultaneously to activate the super moves. All this stuff is common. And then I think, see, in terms of certain combos, that then is where you get into more specificity with the characters. So yeah, that's the thing. I mean, when you're playing the single player, you are continually, I've been just continually using one character to try and just get better with that character. So you know, you could do that, and hopefully eventually I would actually master his sort of particular ability, Sceptile, who's kind of a quick character. I mean, I've seen quite a few people use him. It seems like, in terms of who's like most popular, who might be in a sort of upper tier of play, it seems to be, you know, Lucario's pretty big. Charizard I've seen a fair bit. You know, a few Pikachus. That's kind of the pecking order, as far as I could see.
I see. So Chandelure not high on the tier list, huh?
I'm not seeing Chandelure's amazing, but you don't see him. I haven't seen him online very much anyway.
That's,
I mean,
see,
the roster's kind of interesting because it's obviously not that huge, which I'm not surprised considering this is kind of starting from scratch. You know, I mean, I talked about all the revivals of games, you know, that have gone on in the fighting genre recently, and of course that history gives you this big kind of roster to kind of add to and refine and layer on top of, whereas this is kind of, you know, you only got, what's it, 15 or 16 or something, and I think Mewtwo/Dark Mewtwo the only real unlockables. You unlock support Pokemon and stages and things, but not you know, fighters. The fighters are pretty much just up front, there's everyone, go for it. You know, and I think it's a pretty interesting sort of balance of different types in terms of, you know, the big burly Pokemon like Machamp versus like quadrupedal ones like Suicune, or, you know, quick ones and tiny ones like Pikachu, and then you get Luchador Pikachu and all stuff. I mean, it's I think it's got its merits, but it is, like, compared to what most people probably used to with fighting games at this point, especially, you know, with Smash Brothers and Super Street Fighter 4, and, well, I mean, they're enormous, aren't they? They just add, because they're
not Street Fighter 5, so.
Yeah, I guess that's. But of course, Poké Tournament did famously outsell Street Fighter.
Yes.
5, so, yeah, there you go.
I would say that the, well, and as of March, I think they were pretty decisive that they were not planning DLC. So, like, this is your group, but, you know, it's a cool concept for a game, and I hope it was successful enough they considered doing more of it or more kinds of silliness like this, because anytime you can put the Tekken veneer on another franchise, I mean, you really need to go through with it.
It yeah, seems but like it was, you know, well enough received that. I could see them doing some sort of sequel or something similar for the next system.
I guess some of it may depend on how well the arcade sort of scene component of it goes. I don't know, you know, the competitive stuff. I know they've just had a tournament fairly recently. I don't know anything about that. So, but also, I guess, you know, they might want to see some sort of version on NX. It would seem like another one of those games that could use with having kind of a second chance.
Right.
Things, you know, that obviously has sort of done well enough in the modest environment of Wii U that they think, you know, and with the power of the Pokemon brand, that they think there could be more life in it. I will say, playing locally, obviously you have the thing of, because of this field phase where it's kind of more over the shoulder kind of look, you need to have separate views of the action for
right.
each player, and that's where the gamepad comes into play. And there is, you know, there is a graphical hit that's taken in terms of the frame rate and stuff, but it still works perfectly well. I mean, I've said this before, I'm not a huge frame rate sort of snob with fighting games because I'm not that good. I'm not counting frames or anything. So, you know, I think if still that, if you're not doing it on a super serious level, I think the local multiplayer is perfectly good. And I guess it's just, well, these things, you know, that's kind of fortunate about where you could do that, because the arcade obviously has separate monitors for that, for those arcade machines, for each player, so it was just a kind of a convenience that Wii U was able to kind of emulate that. But yeah, in, with regards to the Siren, we don't know whether how possible that would be for local multiplayer on NX. But I've definitely had fun with it. Like I said, it obviously being a fighting game of this type, especially the first foray into it, you know, they might maybe, I think there was somebody poked around an update and saying that the data mining, there might be some kind of additional characters coming in at some point, but that could just be support Pokemon, because a lot of the Pokemon in this are just ones that you summon when you've had this kind of thing in some of the past, like Marvel vs. Capcom games, all that kind of stuff. We just sort of bring in a third character in that case to kind of do a bit of damage. Or in this case, quite a lot of status effects are important, you know, so it'll do kind of sort of Pokemon style buffs and debuffs, to kind of turn the battle. But it could just be something like that. But it does seem like they it isn't quite, you know, just completely finished and cut off at this point. But understand, it's not some big package or anything like that. I mean, I haven't finished the single player stuff, but certainly from reading Donald/Chaymin, as is probably appropriate in this context, review on NWR, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going to get any more like incredibly diverse or anything.
No.
Unless you're going to be really kind of getting very good at it and taking it online, you're probably going to need someone to play with locally to make it a worthwhile purchase. But if you have, then it's great. And it definitely, having had Tekken Tag Tournament 2, it's more than just a Pokemon skin on Tekken.
Right.
There's definitely enough interesting kind of unique elements to it for me, to make it a sort of justified as a separate experience if you already had that.
It is a mechanically different series.
Yep.
But so I think I will go next because I actually don't have a tremendous amount to talk about. So still playing Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE, and I have a lot of thoughts about that game. But it actually sounds like for once Guillaume and I have echoing thoughts. So I am going to hold off until he is back and I have played more of the game. So instead, I wanted to loop back on to Rhythm Heaven Mega Mix. I spoke about how Rhythm Heaven is one of my favorite series, you know, just in terms of release to release. Like, I get super excited about one and just consume it in a aggressive manner. And I have, within a week, I had, within about 3 days, I had really cleared all of that game. You know, all of the main story progression. And we talked about it on the show. I hadn't gotten that far yet. I hadn't seen any of the remixes yet. I was still trying to get Tibby to the tower, as it were. And there was something about the experience that just wasn't landing the same way as I expect the Rhythm Heaven game to land. And I wondered if it was just me. So I went back and pulled out Rhythm Heaven Fever and played it for about 7 or 8 minutes and realized, like, nope, I still love the hell out of this game. And so I tried to think about what it was, and I think I've settled in on one primary issue, although there's a couple other ones. This is a Rhythm Heaven game that's too wordy. And if you've played a Rhythm Heaven game besides this one, you're probably thinking, how?
Yeah, I mean, I remember playing demos where there was basically no words at all at E3. It's like, well...
No, I mean, yeah. That is Rhythm Heaven, so... Rhythm Heaven DS, Rhythm Heaven GBA, Rhythm Heaven on the Wii. Essentially, you are met with a grid, and as you clear one game, the next item in the grid unlocks, and you just move your icon to it, press A, you get the fancy splash screen with the little eye catch theme, do-do-do-do-do, and then you get a tutorial, and then you play game. And that's it. It's just, you just work your way up, you hit a remix, and then you work your way up the next chain of, you know, 4, 5, 7, however many it is in that game. And you just follow its progression till conclusion. Instead, this game, like, maybe as part of the remix, maybe because I didn't want to make, you know, a dozen remixes, I don't know. But instead, what it does is it does these weird, like, story-driven segments where you get 4 minigames. and a dude with a donut on his head talks to you about handsome donuts a bunch of times. And your friend you're traveling with, a stuffed bear from Heaven World, just acts incredulous, which is the appropriate reaction to the surrealness of this game, but it's not really what I'm here for. Is it funny? Yeah, it can be. You know, you go to this barber shop that's lost its flow, and as you do stuff, like elements of the barber shop come back in, and he tells you about how excited he is that you've, you know, got his barber pole and how it's hypnotic and whatever. Sometimes I just stare at it all day, and Tibby's thinking to himself, well, this doesn't seem safe. But it's not what I'm here for. Like, I'm not here for Rhythm Heaven's The Best Plus fan fiction. You know, I'm here to play rhythm games. And I think it's just that disconnect between game, A, loading screen, splash screen, game, A, to get through the your result. I think it just took me out of it. Like, having to go through these sequences was enough of a disruption from the cadence of these Rhythm Heaven games that it just sort of popped me out. And not having remixes for every batch, I think, was kind of a bummer. I know, because they lumped them down to four, but don't make them four, make them six, and then you can have a remix and you'll be fine. Because the remixes are still the best part of this game. They just are. Like, they are the best part of this game. So there's only five, maybe six. And a couple of them are kind of... there's always a couple that are weak. That's just part of the Rhythm Heaven experience. But with there's only six, if three of them are weak, well, that's kind of sucks.
I'm pretty sure there's 10 remixes in the game.
Are there? Really?
Have you actually done everything?
Yeah, I mean, I've gone and played Tibby's mom.
Yeah, see, again, when you talk to me about Tibby, obviously I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's the house that's also a bear made of gold.
But, you know, that's the thing for me is that, you know, I wasn't a fan of the fact they had all this tech stuff, but of course I didn't actually read it. It was just a slightly irksome process of banging through
text boxes. Say that it makes no more sense in English than it probably did to you in Japanese. It's just nonsense. Like, it's like you would expect it. Like, you would expect Rhythm Heaven to just be utter nonsense. But it is utter nonsense. Like, to the point where I'm like, what? Stop.
This is weird, because usually you love utter nonsense in games.
But like,
I understand. In this case, though, you're right. It comes down to, you expected A, you got A
right.
prime.
And, yeah.
Well, it's sort of A, but...
You received a variant of A.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, the weird little pop-up book segments just didn't do it for me. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You're right. There are 10.
And I played this a year ago, so I'm impressed. I actually remember.
But like, some of them aren't great. So yeah, it's there's just something about this game's cadence that just doesn't feel good. But on top of that, and what actually irks me more is the fact there's 9, I guess, mini games that are locked behind the flow balls. You have to buy them from the store. And flow balls mean you have to clear these challenge modes, which are, you know, 3, 5, 6 mini games on three lives that they've remixed in some weird way. And a couple of my favorite mini games are locked behind this process, and I have to get 10 of the damn things. And it's not super easy to earn those, because, like, the ones where there's a monster who's going to eat your gameplay screen are actually kind of hard.
Oh, yeah, but I loved that. I talked about that play. Tension of the screen getting smaller and smaller, and, you know, the pressure to keep getting beats right. It's another sort of... It's a new level of the game's audio-visual sort of synthesis fucking with you. I really thought that was great.
And I enjoy it. It's just... Like, I wish...
I don't know whether I agree with locking the games behind that,
especially
to be honest,
because you only earn one or two flow balls for clearing one of these challenges, and only on the first time.
Now, there's a couple of elements that just seem kind of grindy. You know, you've got coins in the game which you use to buy stuff. It just seems to be kind of trying to incentivize people to just replay stuff, you know, for the hell of it. And I've got no problem with replaying games in Rhythm Heaven games because, yeah, I mean, I always like to get the perfects, and you have to.
Right.
To do, you know, practice very much does make perfect. You're going to end up replaying these things a lot. But I'm still not really that infused about the idea of, like, well, we're going to have these kinds of currencies and things and kind of make you replay things for some of those games.
So
you
it's...
know? They're older games. They're not, like, the newer ones.
Right.
But still, you know, I don't... It wasn't a huge impediment for me, but I wasn't particularly supportive of that decision either.
So it's
gentlemen,
just...
you're missing the perspective here. In Sonic Mega Collection for GameCube, you had to turn on a given game like 100 times to unlock another game. To unlock ROMs on the disc, you
hold
had to
on,
turn
hold
on. You had to enter and exit a particular game like 20 times or 50 times. That was their way, not beating the game, because they weren't capable of understanding that back then.
Are you implying that Sonic Team
loading.
May be bad at their jobs? Shocker.
I'm just giving you some perspective on how bad the unlocking process for games within the game can be.
But you know, I shouldn't need to earn 10 flow balls to unlock a freaking variant of Karate Man.
I don't know whether it was just they felt like, you know, people maybe wouldn't try those challenge trains or whatever the hell they are. In English, if there wasn't some sort of, you know, carrot on the end of it.
Then don't make me pay to run the challenge. Like, that's the crazy part. It costs coins.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, again, yeah, that's right. So, again, it's like, well, you have to kind of grind for coins to pay to do the challenges to get the balls to earn the old games, which then you could use to get more coins. Like, for me, the way I play those games is so just, you know, methodical and squeezing every little last drop out of it because I love them so much. It wasn't much of an added kind of chore, but I don't think it's a good... That is the one area I think it is the most accessible game they've done in the series in many ways. And I really love the fact that what you've got here is a great sort of combination of portability, which it, you know, started out with, but naturally the Wii game didn't have button controls, which it's, you know, for me it's always been best suited to, you know, but also now the sort of audio and visual kind of level of presentation on par with the Wii game. I mean, it, in that sense, it's the best of all of them.
Right.
But this element of the game, like these sorts of like grindy aspects, I don't think that's going to like make many people kind of who might be a bit skeptical of like absolutely seeing everything in the game. It's probably more likely to put them off
absolutely.
Than the way the older games were structured, which seems like a step backwards in that way. It's a bit odd.
So, like, I didn't feel compelled in this game to go back and try to perfect everything, which is a bummer. Now, I have picked it back up after a week and gotten in there occasionally, like really, really tiny bursts, but there's no way I am going to clear 6+ challenges so I can get 12 flow balls to buy Bossa Nova. Like, I would rather give you 12 flow balls to not have to play Bossa Nova. So, like,
well, I suppose you don't have to spend it on
like,
that.
But
though,
like,
do you?
What
you'd have to, you could spend the balls on whatever you like,
right?
You?
But you I would rather like it's just it seems like an inflated numbers, and ultimately there's no real gain here. I would rather it be tied to like, hey, you did good on just playing these things in a vacuum. I don't know. It is a little frustrating because it takes a while to earn, because some of those challenges, even on the second tier, are quite challenging. And they, as you say, practice makes perfect, but practice costs you 5 coins every time. So
yeah, that's another thing that just that doesn't make any sense to me. I just don't know why you'd want to kind of you're just putting a barrier between the player and trying them. I said if your concern was that people need to be incentivized to try those challenges, which they might, you know, because they're not totally unique content, you know,
right.
Kind of remixing things a little bit to get something a bit of a different type of experience out of the games that are already in there. But yeah, that's just going to put them off. So, you know, making you have to have enough coins on hand to do it. So, yeah, weird decision.
It is a weirdly frustrating game in that way, because as you say, there are parts of this that just feel really good. You know, if I get into a rhythm, which means I'm not in doing the adventures of Tibby, if I'm in like the museum and I'm just picking, which is your grid view, and I'm just picking.
Yeah, you do get to a point where you've just got everything on a grid view, and you know, and you're just picking the one you want to play and just going at it. You know,
I can get in a good rhythm there, and I can, you know, I can experience that cadence. But then I scroll up and see there's like 9 games I haven't unlocked. It's like, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go grind out these freaking challenges so I can get Double Date or whatever that one's called.
There is a funny kind of end game to the challenges in that you do event. I guess this could be considered a spoiler of sorts, but if you sort of get to like the very, very last set of ridiculously hard challenges, you get a bunch of games that get made over with WarioWare characters instead of the Rhythm Heaven characters.
That's cool, and I want to see that, but like...
that is
I'm
tough.
Stuck
Let
on,
me tell
I'm
you
stuck
that...
on the middle layer of challenges where it's like, there's like, you don't have to beat them all to unlock the next set, but I need to beat like 2, and I have really just like hit the bottom of the well right now. It's like, okay, I lost all 3 of my lives on a stupid Monster Maw challenge for Remix Trucks. It's like, okay, well, I give up. It is frustrating when you have a game that is in a series where you ask so little of it, and they try to give you more than you want, and they end up giving you more than you want. But, Michael. You're going to talk to us about some E3 games, are you not?
Yes, so it's not exactly new business. These are games I played almost a month ago now.
God.
Not quite that long. Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks. I'm not sure which game you want me to start off with. I'd rather start off with what you think is of greatest interest to at least yourself, if not the listeners.
Absolutely.
So I think we'll start with Ace Attorney 6, because I know... you and I are both big fans of that.
Yes.
It's a fairly short demo, and if for those who have been to E3 and when they've shown off Ace Attorney games, they're usually pretty straightforward demos. They usually pull the very first courtroom scene from the game.
Yeah, you're Winston Payne.
Exactly.
Gaspin
Payne. It's a Gaspin Payne, you know, introducing, well, you remember how to play? Yeah, I guess I know how to do that. I'll skip this, you know. But, you know, it's an Ace Attorney game. It feels real good. The writing's good. Couldn't really hear the music too well on the show floor.
They weren't doing headphones this time? Oh, okay.
I wore headphones, but the DS, a lot of times the 3DS units that they have are like dev units, and for some reason it seems like their headphone jacks are kind of wonky. And so they're really quiet.
Gotcha.
So I couldn't really hear it, and partly we were getting direct audio, so I was actually plugged into Jared's video camera. So that was another, so I was actually, whenever I moved, it would brush against something and make really horrible crackling noises. That's not part of Ace Attorney 6 though, but really, the new thing in this game is the seance mechanic. And, you know, they've had other riffs on the cross-examination over the years. And so, you know, I'm a little jaded. I say, well, what's really new here? But it felt like kind of a hybridization of the animated sequences that everyone loved that weren't interactive but were very pretty in the last game. And if you go back to like the first Ace Attorney DS game, that new chapter that they added, which is, I mean, they were all new to us in the West, but the one they
Emma,
developed.
The Sky Sisters.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a scene there where one of the evidence is like a videotape, and you have to, you know, watch and rewind and forward a videotape, if you remember.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like that. So the seances have, you know, animated sequence showing the last minutes of or last moments of the victim before they died. And they also show words on the screen that are animated or bigger or smaller, or they may change over the course of that video to reflect what's going on. So there is no real audio, but, you know, they'll have words that represent certain sounds that, you know, the victim noticed, right? And so... And then on the bottom, you have this kind of testimony that's the kind of the expert witness per se, that this the person that's conjuring the seance, who's saying, well, this is what this means, this is what this means, and so I conclude that this is what happened. And so it's an interpretation of the original source truth is the video. You know, in this crazy world, right, with magic and you know the world with Maya and everything. So
yeah.
That's taken as basically that's the real truth, right? What that the vision you were saying is true, but the interpretation may be false or misinterpreted by this expert witness who everyone respects and thinks, well, they're always right, right? So you have to find contradictions between the statements and what's on the video. And so you have to kind of line up the words, right? So there's, you know, four sequences of text panes or five, or, you know, just like a normal cross-examination. And you have to line that up with a particular moment in the video and perhaps a specific spot in that video. So it requires a bit of lateral thinking. There's a lot to juggle, but you can, you know, we had an interview with several of the developers of the game. And they go into more detail about this, but they tried to build in ways to easily hop around and rewind and pause the video. So you got tools to kind of allow you to kind of sit back and digest at your own pace. But I did find that, you know, it was not straightforward, even though it was the first, you know, the first case, right? So I think there's a lot of promise there. I could certainly see room for ambiguity where, you figured it out, but you're tapping on item B instead of item A, right? But it seemed like they were pretty good about catching that recently. In other games where there's more than one valid thing to present, that shows that you understand what's going on. So I have trust them to do a pretty good job of that. Overall, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, it's not going to blow over anyone who went blow over. It's not going to win over anyone who doesn't like an Ace Attorney game already.
Right.
It's certainly more of the same, but goddammit, I want more of it.
So I know one of the things that came up, and I'm pretty sure we brought up during the interview, you did, was the more streamlined approach that 5 had of just like, mm-hmm. you are in a room. You are not leaving this room until you find the thing we want you to find. Go.
Yeah.
How is that here?
Well, like I said, the demo only was of a
courtroom. Oh, that's true. You're right. Oh,
so
God.
We really don't know. My interpretation of what they said in the interview might be that there may be some exploration, but I kind of interpret it more as there are more things to poke around and read that are funny when you're in one of those scenes of. Where you got to find the solution to move on.
More about the houseplant.
I could be wrong. I could be wrong. I kind of have a love-hate relationship for the whole exploration paths because you can certainly get lost not checking one little, you know, pixel hunt piece in a corner of the, you know, branching tree paths of that world for that episode, you know, for that case. But it certainly added a little bit more...
Right.
I don't know, sense of place.
Yeah, I mean, it's things like the evolving character of Charlie the plant in the office.
Yeah.
Where, like, you would normally... In Ace Attorney 5, the only reason Charlie's there is because he's been in every other game.
Hmm.
But, I say that it's a plant. It's a fern. But, is it a fern? I don't know. I think it's like a palm tree, actually. But, regardless. But that he wouldn't have been there in that game if he didn't have to be there. Because that wasn't like you had to go back to the office and just fish around your boss's desk in the first game for no real reason except that you're like, well, I don't know, maybe there's something here. And then you check out the plant and he talks to the plant because this game's weird.
Yeah. So I have no idea what they're actually doing, but I'm hoping that there's a happy medium there where there's exploration, but
absolutely
there's kind of a hint coin type thing where if you really just like, look, which Help. Area do I need to go to now? You know, that would be, I think, the best of both worlds. So
yeah.
We'll see what happens. I really don't know what to expect there. Unfortunately, they, like I said, just a courtroom scene with just Ace Attorney. My brain's not working. It's just a courtroom scene with Phoenix.
Yeah.
Basically. Right.
And really? This game does have the two, the dueling court, which is funny because this is not the Dual Destinies. That was the last one. But it does have the more traditional court stuff. That's still under the Apollo Athena team up, I guess. So
Yeah.
It's they do seem to be willing to step out more as a story writing and environment creation team. Like more in the Takumi area where it's like, I don't know, I'm just going to make a game with a character that you can't bring to the West because Sherlock Holmes is trademarked. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Just try and stop me. So I'm happy about that. And I don't know, these guys did salvage Apollo as a character, so.
They sure did.
Like, yeah. They took the worst character them. In the series, which is an impressive feat because there's a lot of terrible characters, and actually made him salvageable. So good for them. Good for them.
Yep. If you haven't seen the interview, please do check it out. We have it's both really a good. Transcript of it and a video. And Jared did a lot of work on the video. We talked about how to do it and what, you know, whether we'd be able to do it with the translation overlay. And he did an awesome job. It's just better than I could have ever expected. So please, if you haven't seen that on the site yet, check that out.
Yep.
There are two other games that I was thinking of talking about.
Sure.
I mean, we talked about Zelda ad nauseum already.
Yeah, Zelda sort of mute everything else.
Yeah, but E3 was really small, but there were some, you know, other games on display, like Ace Attorney. Two others were Severed and Shantae. And I suspect Shantae is maybe the one that's of greater interest to the listenership. So,
but there, we've seen a lot of Shantaes, to be fair.
Yeah. It sure is more Shantae. That's true.
We've only seen one juice box game, and that was Guacamelee. That's a very different game than this one. So I'd actually prefer if we could talk a little Severed.
Sure. Severed was on display at least at the Indiecade, maybe it was at Indiecade too. There was an indie event that I think IGN helped organize.
Yes.
They had the same thing last year. So there's a whole bunch of indie, you know, developers on this rooftop. And there are a few that are kind of in the Wii U or 3DS space. And then there's a whole bunch that are PC or mobile phone. So there are a few games, and one of them was Severed. Now, Severed, I think, came out a couple of months ago on PS Vita. So it is out there. It is a little bit of a known quantity. But I don't know how well known it is. Its art style is very similar to Guacamelee. We asked them if this was set in the same universe. They said, no, not really. That's just sort of the art style we like. That's kind of our brand image. So, but it has this kind of dark, macabre, look to it.
Yeah, Tales from Space, their first games look the same. So,
yeah. So the idea is that I think that your family has been somehow, you know, taken by the ghoulies or something along those lines. I don't remember the exact premise, but you have to go into like this alternate world or, you know, the mirror universe type thing. And it's at the face of it's a dungeon crawler. When you look at like screenshots of it, it looks almost like a Zelda game or maybe here's my touchstone. If you played Goonies 2 on NES and you go into like the doors where there, you know, you can knock on the ceiling and the floor and the side, that's what it looks like to me, just visually. I mean, that's basically how you progress. They're very nodal. You go from room to room, but you don't really move around within the room. You just rotate. So it's basically there's a cylinder or really layers of cylinders wrapping around you in every room. And so you're going around, you're picking up keys, unlocking doors a little bit like Zelda. But really what you do in a room is you're fighting enemies. And so it's entirely touchscreen based. You might be able to use the D-pad to like move forward and backwards between the rooms. I don't remember. But the primary mechanic is touch-based, and it's about slashing enemies, cutting off their arms. That's a big mechanic.
That's the name.
Hitting them when they're vulnerable and then severing their appendages to collect them, because I guess those are used for your augments, basically. You can use those to augment your various stats.
And you do that by touchscreen, right?
Yeah, that's all touchscreen. So the combat almost felt like, in a way, like Skyward Sword, where a lot of times these enemies would have a shield blocking certain angles. You had to slice from a certain direction. And then it gets a little more complicated with multiple enemies in a room. So you have to turn, you know, rotate around to address enemies. And there's indicators with meters as to, you know, when that other enemy is ready to attack. So you got to kind of juggle this. And I didn't really get the feel for that. I wasn't very good at it, but it was pretty gentle. It was the first dungeon, right? So it's pretty cool. I could see it getting grading over time. I think this is the sort of game you'd probably want to play in short sessions. But it certainly seems well suited for stylus play. You know, a lot of times we say, like, you know, these old touch screens that are using this membrane and
yeah,
you know, they're crappy touch screens. But I guess Vita is the same way, but I don't.
Vita is.
I would not want to use my finger. You know, I would not want to play this using my finger on Vita or iOS. It's coming to those systems, or it has come to those systems, but it seems like that would hurt my finger pretty quickly.
So,
you know,
basically, you just described Trauma Center, the action adventure game, which I'm okay with. Like, that's that okay. when I've seen this game and played that, that's how I'm thinking, right? Like, you have to like draw lines over the enemies in certain ways to get certain appendages off and things.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, maybe kind of. I suspect the bosses do, you know, get more complicated over time. So sure, Trauma Center seemed a bit more meticulous. I've only played one of the games.
Appropriately.
I got fed up with it over time, but
yeah.
It's probably not a bad touchstone. It does feel more actiony though. In
okay.
And also, I mean, the game I played, I think, was the Wii game, and I felt like at times once you started trying to kill enemies, it felt a little too, haphazard. Just, you know, just slash everyone.
Okay.
Whereas this, you do have to be a bit more meticulous, like in Skyward Sword.
Gotcha.
Which, you know, I wasn't great at the Skyward Sword combat, but I appreciate what they were doing. And this has a similar vibe.
Cool.
So, you know, it's cool. I don't know how much they're going to charge for it. I don't know how long it really is, but it got very mixed reviews on Vita. Some very high reviews and some like abysmal reviews. So I liked what I played of it. Like I said, I don't know if I'd be up for playing a full game of it though. So I may come down to price point, whether I'll bite on it. So, you know, the third game I wanted to talk about was Shantae, and there's been a lot of Shantae talk. It very much feels like a successor to the 3DS game. It's just half genie hero. So I was a little disappointed with the locale they showed for the demo. It was Burning Town, Scuttletown, which it seems like that's like the first level in every Shantae game, which I guess it's tradition, but it left me a little more underwhelmed than it should have, because I do like these games. The one thing I really wanted to point out is that the transformations are back. And they feel really good. They're snappy to go between the monkey and the spider creature. And it felt good in all three forms. And it seemed like there's going to be some strategic use of those forms. Like the spider is kind of lumbering. And you have to like duck down if you want to walk a little faster. So it's I can see a lot of kind of situational platforming and things like that where they could make some pretty clever use of these transformations. And as an added bonus, the spider does a grapple upward to grab the roof. So I was able to use the phrase at E3, grapple them titties.
Great.
Which I was very proud of, God given bless. This game. So
thanks. Thanks, yeah, everyone. So
Johnny should love this game then.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so really not a whole lot to say about it. There's a direct feed video of us playing it. On the website and on YouTube. It was my second or third time through that level. So although I'm still shitty at combat in Shantae, yeah, so you can make fun of that. I kind of knew where the secrets were. So you can get a good sense of, you know, what they've crafted here. So it looks good. You know, it looks similar to DuckTales. They're using the same engine, you know, the DuckTales remastered. It looks good. I personally like this all sprite artwork more from the 3DS game, but that maybe just be a personal preference thing. It still looks really good. So look out for that.
Cool.
Yeah.
John.
Yes. All right. I'm still playing through Mylon's Secret Castle.
Why?
You know, I have unfinished business there.
Yes. You know? Deleting Mylon's Secret Castle.
All right. But I'm not going to talk about that this week. What I want to talk about, because I really want to save. I want to save that entire experience for some other
you
day.
You want to savor that experience?
Yes.
Well, weeks. You can at least put the Mylon's Secret Castle music under the discussion here, then.
Yeah,
not
talk hopefully.
About it.
I mean, Lord. All right, but what I really want to talk about.
As the editor, that's not happening.
What I really want to talk about is Pokemon Go, which I just downloaded for my iPhone today. And I'm sure a lot of people have as well.
Yeah, it shot up the money-making scale right away.
Yep. Yeah, so, it kind of sucks. It kind of sucked me in, right? I didn't really necessarily plan on getting it, but then I'm like, it's Pokemon. The thing is, it's free-to-play. Free-to-play augmented reality game developed by Niantic for iOS and Android. So Niantic are the ones that made Ingress, if anybody played that on smartphones.
We talked about it a little bit at one point.
Yep. And so with Pokemon Go, I mean, it shows you create a trainer and you walk around on the map. The whole thing is it's like you walk places to go and capture Pokemon. So the Pokemon, the Pokemon types, they appear sort of in places where you would expect them to be. For example, like if you're near a beach, then you would see water type Pokemon. If you're kind of inland on grass, you would see grass type Pokemon, et cetera, et cetera. Sort of. I mean, you still see kind of different types of Pokemon all over the place, but it's kind of fast and loose with that. But yeah, so it's pretty cool. I mean, it's definitely made with casual players in mind. It doesn't really require much to get up and running. It doesn't require much to run around and capture Pokemon. It's meant to be played as you're literally on the go. What you do is you'll see on the map, you'll see a Pokemon pop up on the map, and once you're close enough to it, you tap it, and then it takes you to a little screen. It shows your camera, and you have to find the Pokemon kind of in your environment. You know, it's usually just to the left or right of the camera. And you find it, and then you swipe upwards, and that throws a Pokeball out. And, of course, Pokeballs, you have a certain amount in your inventory that you can run out of. And you can buy more, of course. That's kind of where the hook is. And that's how you capture a Pokemon, adds it to your Pokedex. I think I was looking, and there's 250 Pokemon in the current Pokedex. So it's
through gold and silver, essentially.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch to
catch. Gee, I wonder what age of people they're targeting with this game.
Yeah.
It's through Pokemon of the year 2000. Gee, that's not conspicuous at all, is it?
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it's necessarily gold and silver. I mean, maybe it's some sort of remix of Pokemon. I'm not too sure, but that's how many that are in there.
Yeah, because people are really clamoring for the Diamond and Pearl Pokemon. I need to get Kofergus out here.
All right. I mean, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And you can evolve your Pokemon. I think as you catch Pokemon...
What's that fucking ice cream cone Pokemon?
As you as you catch Pokemon, you earn kind of currency for that type of Pokemon, which means that you can then evolve that Pokemon. So if you get a Pidgey, you get kind of like Pidgey. I think it's called Pidgey Candy. And so it's like that. You get candy for each type of Pokemon. And so, you know, to evolve Pidgey into, you know, whatever's next, you have to spend, you know, 5 Pidgey candy. And or to evolve it, no, to evolve them, it's like 25 Pidgey candy. If you want to power them up, it's 5 Pidgey candy. So you can make your Pokemon stronger by spending candy, and then you can also evolve them by spending more candy.
So, John, right now I am sitting here, mm-hmm. and I'm staring at the wall thinking, is he just fucking making all this up?
No,
because
it's all real, man.
This just sounds like complete nonsense.
Yeah, it's effectively Pokemon training with, you know, in-app purchases. Really.
Well, that sounds
not
like
that
my
you
nightmare.
Have to do that, but it's like every single free-to-play game out there. It's like, you know, over time you will eventually accumulate enough currency to evolve your Pokemon, but it'll just take you a while.
So if I want Pidgey candy,
mm-hmm.
I want delicious Pidgey candy.
Yes.
How would I acquire, without giving you my cold hard currency, delicious Pidgey candy?
You just keep catching Pidgeys. But as far as I can tell, that's what you do.
So essentially, you are sacrificing Pidgeys to evolve one Pidgey. That,
I mean, in whatever dark manner you want to look at it, James, probably.
My Pidgeotto is the product of 1,000 dead Pidgeys.
Now, as you walk around the
candy,
world, there's also Pokestops where you can get items out of them. Like you kind of like their little, you know, and usually they're like, I think they're actually pulled from Ingress where people have added landmarks in Ingress. I think they're brought over into Pokemon Go. And they're just notable things in the environment, like, a cool now something like a, you know, like a cool a unique park bench or a mural on a wall, something like that. There's some notable thing in the environment that has been turned into a poke stop, I believe they're called, and you go up and you swipe the screen and it spins and it spits out some Pokeballs and various prizes and stuff like that you add to your inventory.
So John, what I need you to do is I need you to
you love the fact that I brought this game up, James.
What I need you to do is I need you to go into your bedroom and set that on ingress and see if it turns into a Pokestop so that you can Pokestop from bed.
You're welcome, James.
Do you have to hit every little like inch of the wall to find the Pokemon?
No.
Not as good as Mylon. I'm sorry.
So, by the way, the episode title is Pokestopping in John's bed.
Again, James, you're welcome. You're welcome. I'm throwing the softball up there. You're knocking it out.
Thank you, John.
So yeah, so it's cool. I mean, it's exactly something you want to do when you're out walking around. You know, I have to say it's already trained me a little bit because maybe I took a different way home just so I could kind of walk by a Pokemon and capture him.
Are you the trainer or is it John?
I'm being trained.
Google and Nintendo combined for John Lindemann mind control.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to let it not take over my life, but, you know, there's a lot of Pokemon out there, James.
Is that why you relate to the show, John? You were catching Pokemon?
A lot of Pokemon. Hey, man. Look, you know, I had to run an errand,
all right?
Did you go, quote-unquote, surfing, John?
No.
To catch a water Pokemon?
How was that Rattata you almost missed the show to catch, John?
Hey.
Is he good?
The only Pokemon that
I've
missed so far.
Is he top percentage?
The only one I've missed so far is... I believe a Bulbasaur ran away from me at one point.
That's understandable.
So, yeah. But right now I have Charmander, Pidgey, Rattata, and I think Squirtle was the one I got at first. I think. So, yeah.
So you basically are you have the basic starter Pokemon right before you fight Brock, essentially. You are dead beginning of Pokemon training experience.
Now, speaking of which, there are gyms scattered around too where you can actually there's like a bunch of them like in your area and you can go and the thing is you have to be level 5. I think I'm currently level 2. So like as you catch more Pokemon, you also gain experience for your character. So I haven't been able to fight at a gym yet, but I believe that's where you earn special like good Pokemon, I think. Because there are particular, like, over the icon is a particular type of, like, there's a Pokemon shown over the gym icon. So I'm assuming that when you beat that gym, you get that Pokemon. I'm not too sure, but we'll see.
Are those also ingress points?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
If you can find that out, you could set your bathtub to be one.
There's probably more homework that in this game with ingress than I'm willing to do, James.
You can make your bat the home of water type Pokemon. Also, PS Vitas.
So you're saying you want a Tub Time Pokestop?
Yeah, I want a Tub Time Pokestop. John Lindemann's Tub Time Pokestop. Yes.
Yep.
That may actually be the title now. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. I like that one more.
Yeah, so you just want me to start gaming this by having a Pokestop in my tub?
I want to see like if there are like people who get hardcore into this and just find ways to like game the integration.
Oh, there absolutely will be.
And see like how hard they try to backplane against that. It's gonna be like the nihilist in me is fascinated how much this begins to consume people. Like, we've already seen from the beta that they did. The beta in New Zealand, right? Like, I want to say it was in Oceania. But we've already seen, like, postings like, hey, I know that this Pokemon Go is in the police station. You don't have to enter the police station to get it.
I think that was in Australia, I think. Where they're like, you can just stand outside the police station. You don't actually have to come in. So, yeah.
That's going to be – there's going to be, like, business owners who have to deal with this. This is fantastic.
Yeah. It's going to be way bigger than Ingress ever was.
Yeah. I am curious when Nintendo's going to start selling the little button. I can't remember what it does. The little lapel Pokeball thing.
Yeah, that's the what is that thing called? It's the Pokemon Go Plus.
Yes.
What that does is, I think if there's a Pokemon nearby, it buzzes. So you don't actually have to take out your phone. I think it connects via Bluetooth to your phone.
Oh, it definitely does do that.
Yeah, and then so if there's a Pokemon nearby, it'll tell you. So you don't have to walk around with the app open all the time. That's the idea. So
you don't have to run the cars because you're trying to catch a freaking Rattata.
Yep, exactly. And that's part of the reason why they're doing it, is because they don't want people like walking into traffic trying to, like, you know, look, always looking at their.
It was a Mr. Mime, John. App. It was worth it.
Yep. Yeah. So it's just, yeah. It's a uses a Bluetooth connection. Yeah. It has an LED and a light rumble.
How long do you think you'll play this? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know. Really, it depends on how easy it is to actually capture a new Pokemon.
Gotcha.
I mean, if it's
just constant really, Rattatas, you're gonna get kind of bored.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm not going to go way out of my way to get Pokemon, but if there's a steady stream of different types of Pokemon, just kind of like on my way back and forth to work, that would be cool. I'd play it for a while, but if it's just the same Pokemon all the time, then I'll probably just lose interest in it.
You're gonna EV train your Zubats that you caught walking to work. It'll be good. It'll be good. Your tub time Zubats will have a good.
I'll let you know. I'll keep you updated.
I am the least mature person in the world, but it's okay. I'll deal with it. So, that's going to do it for new business this week. When we get back, it's time for Listener Mail. It's now playing. A sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review, 7th Dragon 3, code VFD, on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. We know we haven't talked about this game much on RFN, so we figured we'd give it a signal boost by telling you to check out Neil's review. He goes in depth with the title and tells us how it stacks up to the best of the Etrian Odyssey series, best of all. Also next week, look for his review of the demo.
Nicely done, sir.
Oh no.
I'm reading ahead, oh no. Because we also have a review of Mighty No. 9 on Wii U by Brian Rose.
Mighty No. 9 has arrived on Wii U, and it's safe to say that Brian agrees that it's better than nothing. However, he's also not all that impressed, and lets us know why in his review. If you think it stands up to the best of the Mega Man series, well, all we can say is that Kamiya was right.
Indeed.
You know, in the next segment, I call this game a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yep, it's Mighty No. 9 of disappointment.
Mighty No. 9, N-E-I-N.
Played. All right, and we have a review of Box Box Boy for 3DS by Adam Abu Nasser. From the most creative sequel name ever department comes Box Box Boy, the aptly, all caps, the aptly named sequel to Box Boy. It's a puzzle game in which you creatively place boxes in order to make it through each stage, and Adam tells us how he likes it from the view of a series neophyte. Look,
how does he like it?
He loves it. He loves it. Look for the third game in the trilogy, Box Box Hunter, to be released soon.
I thought I was going to go Box Box Boy Boy.
Preview. We have a preview of Pokemon Go, An Evening with Pokemon Go, by Adam Abernazer. Adam regales us with tales of the smartphone game that's taking over the world. As an Ingress veteran, Adam compares Go to Niantic's previous title, Ingress, and tells us what's been added and changed. If you're at all curious about how the game works, his write-up details all the rules and nuances of the game so far. Just don't walk into traffic while reading it.
Alternately?
Yes.
Walk into traffic.
If there's a Pokemon there,
walk into traffic.
You get that Zubat, even if it means jumping off the bridge.
Right. Look, do you think Ash would let that Zubat stay in the middle of the highway. Of course he would.
Yep. That Pidgeotto, it's up that radio tower. You go get it.
That's right. Water Pokemon are near the water. Flying Pokemon are in the air.
Mm-hmm.
You can jump off tall buildings anytime you try to go to NintendoWorldReport.com. But if you before you hit the ground, you will find news, previews, impressions, and all kinds of content, like content above and the interview for Ace Attorney, Spirit of Justice. We're back to the next segment of the rest of your lives. It is time for listener mail, and you can ask these luminaries your deepest ponderings, your corrective questions, the queries
corrective
that will
questions?
Yes, the queries that will set your life back, back in order by emailing rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's a website for those of you who are less enlightened. But that's actually an email address for the website. But if you send us your ponderings, we will pontificate such as this.
You pondering what I'm pondering, James?
Greg, I believe you have the first query.
I do, yes. So Shad from Dixon, Tennessee writes, "What's up, guys? Some of the biggest games in the industry are famous for their formula that tends to be repeated throughout their respective franchises. The most notable could easily be called the Big Three of Mario, Metroid, and Zelda. By and large, most companies tend to have a 'if it's not broke, don't fix it' mentality. But we all know that's not exactly Nintendo style. Over the years, they've tried to mix it up from time to time. Mario, for the most part, was always about running to the right, with some occasional verticality until it went to 3D. While I wouldn't call going polygonal a large change, I would say that about the introduction of Flood in Sunshine. That game was, for the most part, very well received. Then there's Metroid. Explore, get stuck, go find the thing, use the thing, explore more, repeat. They've never really changed its formula up until Federation Force, and that's been horribly received, and it's not even out yet. And now Zelda is doing this. They've added a few tweaks here and there, the biggest being Link Between Worlds' choice out of order, but the formula of item-based dungeon exploration didn't change that much. Now they're upending the proverbial tea table with The Legend of Zelda Guardians Gone Wild and allowing you to do all of the things in any way and order you choose. This is by far the biggest departure from the Zelda formula we've seen. What CDI game? I have no idea what you're talking about. While I'm incredibly excited about this game, I'm worried it won't feel like Zelda. How do you guys feel about it? How do you think the public will feel?"
I'm probably going to cut this down quite a lot, but I wanted to get some back discussion here on what Shad's talking about first. So I'll actually kind of point to a series. It's not in games. It's actually in film. And if you go watch the first three Indiana Jones films, and I'm stealing this from Red Letter Media, so you'll just have to deal with it. They all follow the same cadence. Like, there's a, you know, you meet Indy in a weird but cool way. He is on an adventure that's not really tied to the main plot, usually at the very end of the adventure. Then he goes back somewhere that's more peaceful, finds out about something somewhere that sounds interesting. He goes to that place, collects more information, occasionally runs into a dangerous scrape, and then ultimately finds more information, gets to the thing, encounters the big bad, usually a guy who's super muscular, beats him, then encounters the big bad's boss. That person is usually undone by their own evil.
They get what they want, and it's too much for them. That's the ending of every Indiana Jones.
Then he gets the thing, realizes he shouldn't have the thing, and the thing is tucked away for safety. And they all the only ones we'll talk about here that don't have space aliens
all kind of
follow that same cadence. And it works because it sort of fits into a mold. And that's what he's talking about here. These games have a cadence to them. Mm-hmm. And You can make new ones in the Cadence, but the Cadence defines the series as much as the world, as much as the characters, as much as the environment, because it's integral to what the game is. But in this case, we don't really know what Breath of the Wild, and I actually said the name correctly, by accident, actually. We don't know what the Cadence is here. The Cadence could still be much the same, even if it's wrapped in a different kind of gameplay world.
Well, also, it just seems like it would be more customizable, though. You know, this whole thing about, well, you could go straight to Ganon if you want, you know, kind of thing, like...
Maybe,
you know, it does sound like, yeah. You know, the freedom will introduce a sort of, you'll be able to tailor the rhythm of a game to just your preferences to some extent anyway. But yeah, I mean, there's still,
we'll see.
For as much as obviously TYP and the people at the show got to play it and all that, there's a lot we don't know about that experience.
Well,
so
to be honest, you guys probably know more about Zelda than I played it, but I didn't see any of the Treehouse stuff. I really don't know what was announced or what they said about the game progression. Really, other than a little bit I read after the fact. But I mean, I'm not sure I agree with the premise that Zelda's really going to be, the new Zelda game is really going to be fundamentally different in the high-level structure. I mean, even in the demo they had on display, they showed, they had these shrines, I think is what they used the term, that were like mini dungeons, and in each one they had a new tool that you could use, and use that to solve puzzles. And
right.
I doubt that those tools are really going to be found that way in the final game. They're probably found in bigger dungeons, and just like in the other Zelda game, that those become like the big thing you use to solve and progress through that dungeon. So,
well, I'm wondering if it'll be like a link between world, where you can just get everything out of order and just kind of, it doesn't really feel like a Zelda game.
I think
it
might
have that
be
Zelda Cadence.
I disagree with the notion that Link Between Worlds doesn't have a Zelda Cadence. You guys rag on it a lot. I still enjoy it.
Because it's poor.
It's okay. It's good if you just want a Zelda experience that doesn't feel like a Zelda game.
Okay, guys.
So it's the worst, and it's okay, and it's a Zelda experience that doesn't feel like Zelda. It's a hell of a lot of contradicting itself in a short period of time.
Well, I mean, it's Zelda. I mean, it has all the Zelda clothing, but I mean, it doesn't really feel like a Zelda game. I mean, you could have thrown any character or any kind of clothing on that structure, and it does feel
like one very specific Zelda game, given that it's got the location from Link to the Past.
Let's keep our conversations centered around what's really important, which is the Legend of Zelda.
Change.
Walk
on, Legend
of Zelda.
Not my Zelda.
Walk on the Wild Side.
Yes, Legend of Zelda. Walk on the Wild Side. Yes. But you know, I think actually to the games that Shad mentioned ahead of time, I struggle a little bit with the idea that Mario hasn't been remixed and chopped and screwed, as it were, a bunch of different ways, because in some Mario games, it's about getting to the end. In some Mario games, it's about collecting doodads.
Mario
64
is different.
Humongous shift, not just because it was this pioneering game going into 3D, but you know, it could have been a hell of a lot more similar to the old Mario games than it was. I think you only have to look at stuff like Super Mario 3D Land to see what a more literal sort of translation of the side-scrolling games would have looked like in 3D, but that's not what they did. You know, and so that was a very radical, not just in terms of 3D and polygonal graphics and analog control, but the nature and the structure of the tasks, you know, having these playgrounds and remixing them to have various different tasks, and then you only need a certain to achieve a certain percentage of those to advance into further worlds and ultimately to the Bowser, you know, at the end and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was really radical departure. It wasn't, obviously it had to be, because you know they were doing something so groundbreaking in to some extent, but I think it did go beyond what it had to do, you know, and was even more kind of shook things up even more than that. And then of course that became a formula, you know. James talks about the sort of the cadence, the rhythm of the whole 120 stars, but you only need about, you know, maybe just over half of them to go to the end thing,
right.
And fighting Bowser three times, not in Sunshine, but in Mario Galaxy.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that adopted certain things from Mario 64 as like this very like important template that it kind of had to stick to. And it's like, did you though? I mean, like, were those things like really that creative a decision back then, or was it just what you could do on the N64 for launch, and why should that bind you for like 15 years hence or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no. Sometimes I think they are. While I think Nintendo, does like to shake things up every now and again, with in different ways. Sometimes I would say they are too adherent to those sorts of things, which are not really like defining aspects of the experience for me, but it seems like to James' point again, they feel like it's like this part of this rhythm that people expect from the game, and they don't want to disappoint them.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, there's going to be a Master Sword in this game. I don't know what it'll take to unlock it. There are going to be certain things that sort of cadence and the frosting on the cake, so to speak, is going to be there. They're going to have that.
Yeah,
right.
I think it could be a case of, you know, maybe if the opening is, you know, that we've seen the way we've seen it presented in the demo and the Treehouse Live and all that is pretty reflective of the final product. I think, you know, there is a chance that it will be kind of a, you know, a bit of a fish out of water experience for a time, and then it gradually sort of works its way back to being a bit more conventional Zelda. So there's a bit more of a feeling of, oh, this is so vast and it's different, and you know what, I can do this, I could do that, and then you know maybe as it goes on, perhaps it sort of funnels down towards something that's more familiar. That would make sense to me, but doesn't mean it's going to happen. It's just purely speculation.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, as for you know, feel like a Zelda. I mean, there are other aspects too, right? The controls, combat. That stuff, you know, the crafting system, things like that. I that stuff did not feel like Zelda to me, and I didn't tinker a lot with it. I did not tinker a lot in general when I played the game. I was trying to walk around and see as much of it as I could, you know, and that some of that does worry me. Some of it feels too much like Xenoblade, and I didn't like Xenoblade Chronicles X. So
I wonder if it'll be a hindrance more than anything. If you'll just be like, just get this out of here, you know?
Yeah, that's my concern. The whole dealing with, you know, just, you know, weapons that get worn out over time. And
yeah.
I mean, if that stuff that's all in the beginning and then you get your sword and things kind of fall down, I think that'll be cool. But mm-hmm. I get that crafting shit out of my Zelda game is kind of my attitude there.
yeah, I feel the same way.
And you know, the combat, part of it was I was just dumb. I kept forgetting that I could jump pushing X, so I never did the jump attack. I was super dumb with combat.
It's a pretty significant change, though, to point out, you know, in terms of they've had that auto-jump thing in there since the Ocarina was the pioneering 3D entry for Zelda, the Zelda series, and they've stuck with that all the way up till now. So, I mean, that is one evidence of this being a kind of more decisive like break than we've had before, where they've kind of tinkered with the formula or introduced some things. But, you know, I mean, I would say, you know, again, going back to James' point, the whole, you do three things, then you find the Master Sword, then you get 4 to 7, whatever.
Right.
That is the cadence of the Zelda game. And that is even before the 3D games. That's Link to the Past.
Right.
And while A Link Between Worlds did mess around with that in terms of choosing the order, it still had that rhythm to it. It's
yes.
You know, you still had a set of three that you could choose, and then you know, something you in the middle involving a sort of big game changing kind of event with the Master Sword, and then we get another larger set which you could sell. And certainly, for again, we don't know exactly what it's going to be, but it does sound like that is not going to be the case here. That again, I think is fair to say. In that sense, it probably will feel, in terms of a progression kind of arc, substantively different than the other games. So, I mean, I could see where Shad's coming from that point of view. But I mean, in terms of how I feel about that, I'm not sure. It's you know, that cycle, if you like, is very well travelled at this point. So while I wouldn't demand that it be junked, you know, I do kind of feel a little bit like what I said about the 120 stars in 3D Mario's and all that. It's like, does it absolutely have to be this way? You know,
sure.
You know. So I'm not sad to see it go necessarily, but of course, what's in its place is not something that naturally appeals to me a lot in terms of this this promise of openness. Is I'm conflicted about it. Open world games have not really appealed to me a great deal.
I think it's about an issue of crafting. Like, can you craft something that feels like there's progression? And I know that was one of your big complaints, James, about Link Between Worlds, was that there was no real difficulty curve, except for maybe the last dungeon once you know you have done everything.
Right.
But
even then, it was like, it didn't know what weapons you had or what items you had, so it's like, well, we can't use them.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, so again, that sort of lack of specificity could harm this game as well.
And I will say, of the little we saw, and I say that, we saw like 87 hours of streaming of this damn game, but there did appear to be multiple solutions to the problems. So there was the room where there was a cannon and you could put bombs in it and shoot stuff over. Or you could use the gravity or the time stop and like tap into your you know, your inner magic power and just like charge this thing up and just ride it across. So the answer was it did expect you to have something, but there were choices. And of course, recently the video has come out of somebody building essentially a Link catapult using a boulder. So I'm on board. Using a log, a boulder, and another log, I think, and then launching Link into the air. So
it'd be interesting to see how they can avoid, like, to have it open-ended, you know, it seems like it's interesting. It seems like it certainly, you know, would be a big change from the sort of very sort of scripted, directed direction that Zelda's gone in, where, you know, of course it originally began as something very open, but it was also something very simple. You know, when you're dealing with all these sorts of items and physics and all this, it goes way, way more complicated than, you know, the original Legend of Zelda. So to have that be open is and still be fun is quite a bit more demanding. But I wonder, you know, if when you have multiple solutions, it kind of reminds me of what people used to say about Scribblenauts in terms of like, well, you know, people just ended up using Jetpack for everything or whatever. I never played Scribblenauts, so I don't know whether that's actually true or anything.
Oh,
but
it's totally true. Because essentially it was like, all right, the answer they want me to do is Fire Truck, but F Fire Truck. Jetpack, done. Problem solved.
So, you know, I do worry that, you know, again, the lack of a very specifically crafted challenge in certain areas might drain some of that sort of lateral thinking, problem solving joy that I, you know, for me, especially because I started with Link to the Past and not the original, you know, it sort of seems pretty inextricably linked with the series to me. But, you know, we assume there will be, you know, very major dungeons in the game. I think there was some talk about there being four of them, possibly, you know, when they were talking about the wider game that was beyond what was being shown. And hopefully, you know, at least in those places, perhaps, like I said, they might be able to just sort of funnel things down a bit. And create something that really feels well sort of crafted and specifically designed to sort of challenge you in certain ways and still have it feel meaningfully open otherwise. It's a real balancing act. I do have concerns that it might not feel like at least what I like about or have liked about Zelda for these past many, many years. But, you know, at the same time, I'm not doom and gloom on it at all. You know, I mean, there's a lot of encouraging signs there.
Yep. So, I mean, ultimately, this is where, like, do we need a siren for this game like we have for NX? And to a certain extent, yeah, we probably
We have
do.
Only seen 1% of this game.
But I think ultimately, you know, I am more interested in this than I was before seeing it, because whenever they were like, well, what we started with, the Link Between Worlds, I was like, no, don't do that, don't, bad direction. So I like the idea that they're gonna do something that's different for them that seems appealing. And I'm not a big open world fan, but it looks like a cool world, so I'm okay with that. Like, if the world is cool, the fact it's an open world doesn't really matter. It just means it's a cool world to be in. So
yeah, that's what I enjoyed about Xenoblade Chronicles.
Right, so, you know, so I'm there for that.
Was the landscapes and everything to explore.
Crafting and item selection shit is like how you progress through the game or unlock or upgrade or get your extra things before going to fight Ganon, F that. I'm out of here.
It does seem to be that component has been creeping into Zelda for a while. That
it has.
Isn't a total blow.
Right. There was definitely crafting in Skyward Sword.
Yeah, but it was, you know,
it's fairly peripheral.
It's superfluous.
I barely touched it.
Yeah, you know, like it wasn't hugely integral to the game or anything. So I guess the real question is, yeah, if that is now like the core progression to some extent. Without the usual kind of items, you know, key
right.
items that you kind of had before. Yeah, I'm not sure how I would feel about that. Because I guess the games that it, you know, it's taken from there, you're kind of, you know, that are very big in Japan. You know, I've never really got all the way into those, you know, so I suppose you could say, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand, the open world angle seems like it's appealing more to Western players, you know, used to Western RPGs and Skyrim, that kind of stuff. And then all this crafting and like making food and all this is more, you know, Japanese and Monster Hunter, you know, you're mm-hmm. living off the land, kind of Metal Gear kind of stuff. I mean, it's yep. Snake Eater type of stuff. Like, it's a weird cocktail of stuff, actually. Certainly more outside influences present than we're used to seeing from. So, although, you know, Zelda, you know, taken from plenty of other things in the past, like Team Eco stuff, you know, people used to say and all that. But this seems like it's got quite a cocktail tail of influences that might change how it feels in a very substantial way.
Cool. Well, I think we're going to move on to the next email. And GX writes, "Dear tiny men who live in my headphones, Lost Reavers, Devil's Third, Mighty Number 9.
What these games
have in common is that they are Unreal Engine 3 and significant technical problems. Although my understanding of architecture is limited, the Wii U's raw power seems like it would be enough to run Unreal 3. But cursory research says developers struggle with it, and Epic comes off as dismissive of the console. Clearly work was done to get the engine running, but not effective work. With the rest of the industry moving towards architecture standards more akin to modern PCs, is there enough pressure to get Nintendo to do the same? Do you think moving towards this standard would encourage engine and software developers to take Nintendo a bit more seriously? Does Nintendo legitimately care about that? After multiple generations of similar hardware, can Nintendo's developers effectively transition to new architecture? Thanks, and I hope everyone's eyes haven't glazed over at this weirdly specific question."
I hope Nintendo takes this seriously. Well, whether they will or not, I don't know.
I want to say about those three games, there's one other deterministic element here. They're all bad.
Yeah, they're all made by bad developers, maybe.
All right.
I'm trying to think of
or on the cheap in Lost Reavers' case.
Yeah, exactly. On the cheap or like by the B or C team.
Mm-hmm.
I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit this issue has kind of crossed my mind with regard to Bloodstained, because
yeah.
that is a similar thing. It's Unreal bones behind it Mighty Number 9, even though it is a, you know, a 2D game, essentially a side scroller kind of game. But and that Armature are handling that, like, you know, that was actually part of the Kickstarter, wasn't it? It's like you have to raise this much money to pay Armature to find a way to get Unreal 3
right.
running well on Wii U to be able to have a version of Bloodstained on it. So that very much crystallizes the issue that GX is talking about.
And Armature has basically said they're going to make that version of Unreal 3 available. But when he says that...
Yeah, when it's coming in 2017 or whatever, I think
yeah.
it's going to be
yes.
a moot point by then.
But when he said that Epic's not... I mean, Epic just wasn't interested in putting in the resources to do it themselves. Is the Wii U capable of running Unreal 3? Absolutely. There are Unreal 3 games on the Wii U that aren't terrible. Mm-hmm. The two Batman games that came out on Wii U both run Unreal 3. So Arkham Origins and Arkham City. Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell Blacklist on Wii U runs Unreal 3. And it's fine. But again, those companies had to make Unreal 3 run on the system because Epic didn't release an official build of Unreal 3.
Yeah, and of course the other commonality with those three is the Japanese side of it, who, you know, were not as familiar with you, whereas that, I guess, you know, Western developers got to grips with Unreal 3 in general, probably, you know, much
five or six years ago at this point.
Support would also be a lot easier too on the Western side of things, since it's, you know, Epic's a Western-based company.
Until Unreal 4, as I believe in Unreal 4, Epic actually has really expanded their support for Japanese developers. I will say that the standard chipset thing matters to some degree, but not as much as you would think, because there's a lot of variants of Unreal Engine out there. So Unreal 3, for example, can run on iPhone. Mm-hmm. It just can. Like, there's a version of it that runs on iPhone. What's that series they have that's just you scratch the screen and a sword swings?
Sever? I remember this.
Infinity Blade.
Infinity Blade,
yeah,
yes.
Infinity Blade, yeah. I think John.
Because for whatever reason, like, Apple's like, this is our thing. But the reason it was is because it was an Unreal game. It was an Unreal game on a mobile phone. So it was never a power thing. It was simply an issue of they just didn't make one. I think what you'll see is Nintendo, it is probably not going to make another power PC-based system. Yeah. I mean, not least of which because I don't think there's power PC chips still being made.
There are, but they're in very specialized.
Right. It's not fields. It's not like it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 12 years ago. So it would be almost cost ineffectual for them to do that.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, Nintendo's going to look at cost. And one of the problems that they have with Wii U is that they built hardware. It wasn't so much with the Power PC, but, you know, with the touchscreen controller, the gamepad, where they weren't able to reduce costs of manufacturing over time very well. And they're going to look at it from that perspective, because they got burned bad, I think, on that on the Wii U, which is why one reason we didn't see, you know, big price drop. So they're definitely thinking about that. And if they thought that the, you know, going to an x86-64 architecture was a way to ensure, you know, reductions in costs, I think they would jump on that. But I think you're going to change architectures, but that may be more to something that's closer to a mobile processor, right? Especially if they're trying to do something that's also handheld. Well, you know, those things are built for low power consumption. So,
like an ARM processor.
I would
processor.
Not be surprised to see an ARM
we know they
system.
We know they prioritize that. That's for sure. And that is going to be
and
something.
And Nintendo does
at.
Have experience working with ARM stuff on their handheld division. Mm-hmm. Like they've been using ARM processors since, what, the Game Boy? Effectively? Like, so they know
what... Z80 an ARM processor predecessor?
Is it... oh, God, you're right. The Z80's everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, that was original Game Boy, but yeah, I guess yeah. GBA had.
Yeah, I think it was.
But DS had two ARM processors. 3DS, I think, has two ARM processors. Like, they know that architecture, and we have one thing we've seen. You know, you can build more powerful things in that configuration, and we've seen ARM sort of pop up in new places. And there is probably a version of Unreal that runs on ARM processors, or I mean, there's more to it than just that. But like, you can. There is probably a version of Unreal that would be fine on a system built around a powerful enough ARM processor and graphics card.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was a bad situation. It was an unpopular system on a weird chipset, and Epic smartly realized that there wasn't going to be big support by Western third parties on the Wii U, and that their Japanese third parties probably weren't going to use their engine anyway. So we're not going to bother, and it's self-perpetuating. No, then somebody else had to do the work, and nobody else wanted to. Or if they did, they were incompetent. See Mighty No. 9.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. What it shows, like you said, is of course it can be done well, but it's not a matter of course. You know, there's obviously some sort of barriers to surmount, and in some cases... like Mighty No. 9 and the others that GX mentioned, those hurdles don't get crossed and it goes badly. Hopefully, you know, Armature could do a good job with Bloodstained. If they don't, or if they can't, or whatever, then I guess you'd be hoping that NX would have some kind of different architecture that would make like a straight port of the other versions a lot easier. I guess that's the kind of.
And they're also solving this for Vita too. So like Armature's got its work cut out for.
Seems like Mighty Number 9 did kind of succumb to its.
Mighty Number 9 was a Ponzi scheme. You know, let's just call it what it is.
You know, so hopefully that is not the kind of fate that's going to befall Bloodstained or other those sorts of things. So for, you know, just you know, better
are you familiar with the plot of the producers? That's Mighty Number 9. That's Mighty Number 9.
I am familiar. Some people say that is the plot of Trump's campaign as well.
and in the case of Devil's Third, this was a game that started on platforms where Unreal 3 was a well-worn path to making your game. In fact, Unreal 3 was sort of the, you know, in a lot of ways, was sort of the look of that generation. You could look at a game and go, oh, there's Unreal 3.
Yep.
Hi, Unreal 3.
Yep.
And, you know, that game was hastily moved off of dying platforms onto a stillborn platform because Nintendo, for whatever reason, paid money for this stupid, stupid game that gifted us only Ivan the Terrible and an interview that looked like it was shot as like an ISIS film. So thanks for all of that. Thank you, Nintendo. Thanks, everybody. And shockingly, that game's not very good. But Valhalla did get Unreal 3 running on Wii U, which means they are the fourth or fifth people to do this independently, which is crazy.
Yeah, sure. But that's the thing, though, is that as much as you can, I mean, the Devil's Third seemingly has many problems, besides the technical. But yeah, you can poke fun at the developers or whatever, but as long as there are barriers there, it's going to have an effect. You know, it'll take more time and effort to surmount them. Some people just aren't going to bother with that, or that's why you want them gone for the next
system.
Right,
so what it boils down to is Nintendo willing to whatever, make good, or do whatever overtures are necessary to get these different kinds of, you know, middleware software developers on board. And yes, that may involve money ads. And but Nintendo historically has shied away from that kind of stuff. And I just see at this, especially, you know, Epic seemed like at some point they were very vocally against Wii U. You know, they trashed it and, you know, in certain forums publicly. So I'm a little pessimistic here. I don't know that they will make good, and you know, Nintendo may just say, "Well, I'm just going to do what damn it."
It's tough to say. It's tough to go against years and years of history of Nintendo just not giving a shit. Like somehow, like they're going to like magically overnight just say, "Oh, well, now we just operate like, you know, like Sony does."
If Epic starts getting calls from publishers who are like, "Hey, are you doing Unreal 4 for NX?" Guess what they're going to do?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to do an Unreal 4 for NX. They'll go, "Oh shit. Somebody get on that." And they'll figure it out. If they had been getting calls to do an Unreal 3 on NX or for Wii U, it would have happened. Cuz as we said, you could have done it. They just said it wasn't worth their time, ultimately. Epic will always have this culture of like more now, faster, better. Look at how many veins we can have pop out of the neck of the monster here.
Well,
yeah,
but that's the thing. If Nintendo doesn't go to them in the first place and say we want Unreal Engine 4 to work for NX, developers aren't going to get word of that, so they're not even going to come back and demand it. You know,
it depends.
Well,
also, they're already making an Unreal game,
about the...
and they say we want to make an NX version. They're going to call and go, "Hey, are you working on an NX version of your engine?"
But they're going to assume, because Nintendo never cares about Unreal Engine, period, they're going to assume that Nintendo isn't doing it. So
yeah,
Nintendo has to start
I think
that.
When we've talked before about these kinds of vicious circles and, you know, reinforcing perceptions that Nintendo has with third-party issues because of, you know, how things have gone over successive cycles, and it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think, therefore, you know, there's a case to be made that you would need some kind of, you know, path-breaking intervention that might involve throwing money around or making special efforts. And that's where you feel like, I'm not so sure they would do that. You know, like, not that they absolutely don't care, but do they care enough to do the heavy lifting to solve these problems when people just kind of have these entrenched expectations that they won't.
You know, I think this is a good example where the leadership changes within the Nintendo corporate structure may result in a different decision on this kind of a front. I wouldn't hold my breath, but I could see if, you know, if Reggie really is, you know, on equal footing as other people on the board, and he raises this, hey, we really want Western support, and it could happen. I just, the traditional Nintendo corporate culture suggests otherwise.
I don't
think... You guys come to us, it's our platform. You guys came to us for the NES because it was so popular, so you're going to do the same thing, damn it, just like you did with the Wii U.
That
tends to be their attitude.
I don't think there was any amount of money they could have thrown around, though, to get Epic to go, yeah, we'll make an Unreal 3, fuck it, let's go, because they didn't see that there was a customer base. I think that's ultimately what's going to be the deterministic factor here. Do they see there are customers like publishers?
If Nintendo had paid them enough, they would have built it anyway, because they would have made a profit on it.
Yeah, but at some point, what does Nintendo need to do that? Like, does that make sense for them economically?
Does that make sense for them? They've got to see the light at the end of the tunnel to do that. That you know, the games that then makes more, you know, feasible or attractive as prospects for developers and publishers. How much does that drive up their, you know, their sales of hardware and software, and therefore how much money is it worth spending? And you know, Nintendo tends to be pretty conservative.
Well, and
about
they could look
that
at
sort of stuff. You know, if they don't feel really confident that it's going to deliver a return, they're not going to.
And we got to wrap this one up because we've been going for a little while. But they also probably looked at it and said, two of like the four biggest Western publishers have already solved this question, so maybe we don't need Epic to worry about it, because where there's a will, there's a way at these publishing houses. They'll figure it out.
So, I mean, I think there's kind of a bigger underlying issue, which is just those perceptions in general about, you know, what place third parties have on Nintendo platforms, and especially Western third parties and their type of games, and how receptive the Nintendo base is to that sort of game and all that kind of stuff. Those sorts of perceptions are really sort of part of the problem here. And then if you've got any kind of hardware, you know, very practical things that just add to that, then yeah, it reinforces it. It kind of crystallizes it that way. But you know, even if the architecture, with, you know, as GX talks about, is not a problem with the next platform, those sorts of perceptions and all that could easily create a similar result. So I think, you know, there's more to it than just the hardware. There's the relationships, there's the expectations, all this stuff. You know, and that's, popularity can help break some of that down. But obviously, as you kind of saw with Wii and DS, it's not everything, you know, because even they, for all their success, you know, had difficulty kind of reaching certain kind of parts, you know, in terms of developers. Obviously, they were underpowered compared to other platforms and things, but even just, you know, the popularity of certain DS games just kind of collapsed, didn't they? You know, the DS market after a time, with the rise of mobile and all that, softened, and the audience that's left apparently just isn't that amenable to certain, you know, to Western developed games. That's going to be the bigger problem I see in terms of overcoming those preconceived kind of notions about what people are willing to play on Nintendo stuff.
Yeah, I think we need to move on, but it's NX Siren here, all that stuff. Like, we just don't know what we got going on, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this matters going forward once we know what the hell NX actually is. I think we've only got time for one more email. Mike, if you could read the last email.
Jordan writes, "Hey guys, I wanted to ask about how Nintendo could make their My Nintendo program more engaging and interesting. I don't know anyone who is using or interested in the 15 and 30% off coupons being offered for coin rewards on My Nintendo on the My Nintendo website, myself included. Those meager discounts pale in comparison to the regular sales offered by Microsoft and PlayStation on their digital stores. Is Nintendo just behind the times again? I know that Nintendo does not frequently offer discounts on its games, Virtual Console being a prime example, as it doesn't want to undermine the value of its properties. But as more and more people are buying games digitally, I think we have already become more conditioned to expect and respond to significant discounts. PSN flash sales and the Steam Summer Sale are just two examples. My question is this: what can Nintendo do to make My Nintendo a more enticing program? Do you see the service changing in the near future, or perhaps when NX arrives? I think we've already seen the change, and that is My Nintendo.
Well, I mean, that's what he's talking about, though. My Nintendo doesn't really, even right now, the rewards are a bit pedestrian.
Yeah, to say the least. Oh, sorry, I didn't finish the email. There was more there, wasn't there?
I'd love
to hear your thoughts. Keep up the great work. Cheers.
Okay, that's fine then. Yeah. Much appreciated. But right now, so they actually just did a big refresh on what is out there, and it's gotten better. In my opinion, some of it's gotten better. So, like, you can now get the Mario Kart DLC pack for coins.
But here's the problem. I feel like the approach they're taking here, it's almost punishing people who are loyal Nintendo fans because they already have all that kind of stuff, the stuff that they want.
That's true.
I really feel like the Digital Deluxe program was a better option because you're rewarding people for purchasing products. You're not tying them to what they get that discount on. And although, yeah, technically you're allowing your games to be slightly cheaper in price effectively because, you know, you're crediting them. You can still say, no, this thing's $60. Even if someone really only paid $55, you're saying, no, the MSRP here is $60. That is what we're charging. You just happen to have some credit there. And I really think that worked a lot better. Maybe it's just because I'm coming from perspective of already owning a lot of these games. But
yeah,
and maybe that'll change with NX. If they have these discounts. And then
yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I think that's it will be kind of fundamentally different with NX because everybody's like kind of getting in at the same point there, aren't they? You know, you haven't had a platform or platforms out for years already where, you know, they've already built up the catalog and especially your power users like us, we've already plundered the catalog. So what can they offer that's that attractive apart from a sort of digital deluxe type of program where you just go straight back into eShop credit? I mean, I feel like that's the biggest thing they could do right now is just offer more choice. You know, either have like a lot more discounts or just offer something that's straight to credit.
And build stars on the European system.
It's not gonna. Yeah, that was very very kind of not very generous, shall we say?
It's 120 gold coins to get new Super Luigi, or 170. So not very generous is defining this system.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I would say, you know, you could have maybe like some sort of general kind of credit option, which maybe wouldn't be as generous as the specific game discounts, but, you know, something like that, just something that feels like people are at least getting, more kind of agency over it, I think, for now. But yeah, I think with a new platform, it will be different. So there is that, you know, just the fact that everything's new. And also, I almost feel like this is some sort of weird, like, trial period or like a pilot for the real deal. So, because there's some really odd choices, like the whole way that you don't even earn any gold coins if you buy something that's under the $5 threshold, isn't it? Whereas, you know, but a lot of things are under the $5 threshold. Like NES games and Game Boy games and all this sort of stuff. I wonder whether once we get to the NX stuff, like there's going to be a lot less that is under that threshold, presumably, rather than sort of cutting off. So because at the moment it seems a bit odd to kind of, as much as having this program provides an incentive for people to buy things digitally, then anything that's digital that doesn't you don't earn those coins almost feels like it's a penalty or a disincentive.
Yeah, it's a waste of your time.
Yeah, which I mean, it's a small thing, but why would you have that?
The stuff expires. Right? It's like I don't want to spend my coins right now. You're kind of forcing me to spend it either on something I don't care at all about, or that I already own. So what's the point? And all things seem like a mess. And you know, part of it's that, you know, in Japan, there are a lot of these kind of loyalty programs. And a lot of times it's like get 1% credit or 1%. And it's usually a very, not very generous loyalty program, to say the least. And so that's part of where you have to look at this too, is that Nintendo, just like with other things, they're taking a very Japanese approach to this. And so, yeah, you're not going to see the kind of deals on a Japanese platform run by Japanese people as you're going to see in the West with Steam sales. It's just, it's a different culture.
But I suppose Sony, though, is the example as well, that they are more, I don't know whether it's just, you know, how they handle these things on the Japanese Sony store, but you will get, you know, good sales on Sony stores elsewhere in the world.
I mean, they'll have flash sales in the US. They just had
We've discussed this on this podcast before.
They put a bunch of stuff on.
Sony's really a multinational corporation, far more so than the way Nintendo is.
Yeah, at this isn't Sony Games run out of the West anyway? At this point, it's run out of California at this point. But the larger issue really on how their discounts tend to happen is a lot of times it's third-party stuff going. So Suikoden was on sale again this week, because it's always on sale for like 60% off, 70% off, 80% off. And we do see those sales pop up on Nintendo downloads. It's actually a segment of the article every week talks about.
No, and that's worth mentioning, because if you go back to Wii, that era, that there was virtually nothing that ever got put on discount or sale. I mean, it was very, very rare event that anything, whether it was Nintendo stuff or anything else. Now, these days, it's like the Nintendo occasionally has sales. Oftentimes, it might be to coincide with something, a Kirby game's coming out. Well, we've got some Kirby Virtual Console games with 20% off or something.
That's good.
But it does also allow the third party games that are indie games and stuff that are on there to be discounted pretty regularly. I mean, you know, like Atlas games always seem to be getting, I mean, like super regularly.
There's always an Etrian game on sale
Even the ones that have come here, you know, Nintendo has relaxed its policies and kind of, you know, it still seems to, kind of hold its own stuff, you know, without being discounted too regularly, but at least they've opened it up for the other developers to kind of, to cut the prices as they see fit a bit more. But I guess that's the thing. I mean, if with the Nintendo stuff, you know, this loyalty program, that's why I think it's tempting, like Jordan kind of sees it as like a substitute for those sorts of discounts, because you do see the third party games get them, but not so much the Nintendo stuff. And then it doesn't compare that favorably, I guess. If he was going to ask which you'd rather, like this sort of program or just like the kind of discounts that like those Atlas games get, which are, you know, high quality games. I mean, they might not be Nintendo games, but they're very well thought of, and the hours of entertainment and all that. That looks like a much more attractive value proposition. But I think that's when you get back to Nintendo having, even though they've relaxed on these things somewhat, they still have this belief about protecting the value of their properties, as Jordan says, and the Japanese sort of view of it.
I have a question. I mean, I did buy some stuff on sale, and there was a slight discount, and it said on the eShop, just for you, and I wasn't sure what that meant. Is that like a specialized...
We've had this conversation before, and we never have the bodies to test if that's true.
Yeah, all the stuff I've seen so far under the Just For You banner is stuff that everybody's had. So it feels like this weird like half rollout. Like they haven't actually
Just For You and all of your friends
point yet. But it just feels like, you know, at some point there's gonna be a bit more kind of nuanced, or you know, with this in terms of maybe targeting people. You know, I mean, the thing that I would think they'd like about this kind of program versus something as direct as the Digital Deluxe is like that they can kind of push things around more, just push specific things at specific times, and maybe like tailor it to individual, to people based on what they play, and maybe trying to nudge them to try games that you think they might like, but they don't know it yet, or something.
That's complicated.
They want to exercise some kind of level of control with this program that you can't just by giving people block credit. as a kind of a rebate, like they did with the Digital Deluxe program. But the thing is, if that is what they're building to, they're a long way away from it at this point. Because I said the Just For You stuff is just, it was Smash Brothers discount for 3DS and Wii U that was under that.
Well, you already own it.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't already own at least one of those? But you know, like everybody got that. It wasn't just
for you to buy it again.
It does kind of suggest that they're paving the way for more personalized or kind of targeted offers that they're trying to try and, I don't know, like go back to some of these things in the past where, you know, they always had trouble kind of selling people on RPGs, you know, in the NES, Super NES era, you know, and they kind of wanted to push people that way, maybe like, oh well, if you like Zelda you should try this, or you know, maybe this is going to be their vehicle for overcoming those sorts of problems.
I'll say even Steam, which has been doing the custom recommendations and stuff, isn't very good. Like right now it's trying, I just pulled it up to see what it wants me to buy. It wants me to buy a bunch of roguelikes. It's like, no. It wants me to buy a Neptunia game. It's
since
like,
you liked Pokemon Mystery,
it's like,
Dungeon.
Hey, do you want to buy Neptunia and roguelikes? No, I don't want my Nep, thank you. I'm good.
Yeah.
So like
since you liked Honeycam, what?
Oh yeah, so it's a dire situation. Like that's hard stuff to do. It's really difficult to put together, you know, something that can put together patterns and say people who like these games, this is why they like these games, and these are the games that represent that, without just resorting to labels. Oh, this person bought a lot of RPGs, which is probably why I ended up on that with the roguelikes, because those are also usually labeled as RPGs. It's like, oh, you'll like No Man's Sky because it's set in space, and you played Kerbal Space Program. Well, no, those are very different things. So it's difficult to do. It just is. And
but also that kind of feels like that's more, you know, that's more the utility of a loyalty program to them,
right?
Not to us.
Well, no,
you know, like, but, you know,
that would be it, to your point though. If they want to give you discounts as opposed to just giving you credit to get you to look at things.
Oh no, yeah, that's the idea.
You have to be good at giving me things to look at.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's kind of like, you know, we normally would say, look, just give us the block credit and we'll use it the best way. We don't need you to decide it
for us.
So
essentially,
to
put this in the context of federalism, you are saying, no, government, we know what we want to do. We've got this under control. Don't tell me how to spend my money. But instead,
which amendment is it again?
Well, actually, it's not an amendment.
I mean, when people say I'm a whatever amendment guy,
oh,
it's just like devolve power to the states.
Yeah, yes. But instead, Steam is recommending, despite the fact I've never hooked up a VR device to it and would never, ever, 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 ever play this game, is recommending Fruit Ninja VR as my number 10 most recommended game. Because machine learning is hard.
It's aspirational, James. It's aspirational.
There is nothing aspirational.
That's what they want you to work
towards.
There
is nothing aspirational about Fruit Ninja.
Yeah.
It is giving up defined. Oh God. I would actually like to see them get an effective recommendations thing. Now, to your point, for us it's no good because I get the press release every week, and when I see something and I go, what the hell is that? I click on the link and I am distraught. Generally speaking, I am distraught. And then if I'm not sure if I should be distraught, Don Koopman's got me covered. And then I know, oh, yes, distraught was the appropriate reaction here. So I know what's out there, but it would be good. You know, sometimes I forget. Sometimes there's an NES game that comes out and I don't even know what to make of it, like Flying Dragon, The Secret Scroll. Suddenly comes out 1 week, and you go, what the F is that?
I mean, another thing I would say is that, you know, one of the things that should be better about My Nintendo is, you know, getting more people to participate in it than they did in Club Nintendo, you know, kind of doing away with the onerous survey process and, you know, tying it in with the smartphone and Miitomo stuff and accounts you already have and all that. Like, you hopefully you'd get to the point where if you have a successful platform – on NX and this really easy sort of program to opt into that, you know, you, they're going to be able to push stuff to people who aren't like us, you know, that aren't as aware.
Right.
You know, that's what they're eyeing. So that's the weird thing about it. Again, it's like it does seem like it's a loyalty program that's not particularly aimed at the most loyal customers.
No.
But
is it earning gold coins requires you spend a significant amount of money. So it's hard to understand where the, you know, where the division is. So I don't know. Like I don't know to whom this is currently targeted, and I just have to assume that we do not know what NX is, and we do not know what the,
yeah, that's the problem. That's all.
We do not know the full future of My Nintendo and the Club Nintendo Rewards, or not Club Nintendo, whatever they call them now, the My Nintendo Rewards.
Yeah, I would imagine that it will change significantly, you know, once you get the new platform. It seems like it's in this kind of nascent form at the moment. But if I was going to boil it down to one thing to say make it more enticing, just more choice.
Totally.
Just give us more choice about how we exercise this sort of quasi credit that we've got with the platinum coins and the gold.
Make it
gold coins.
Feel. I've never really felt like. I mean, I've bought a lot of games. And I've never really felt rewarded for it. It's like, here's discounts on games that you already own. Great.
What's your? Do you have a ton of gold coins queued up?
I don't even know. I haven't even checked, honestly. Okay. It's just.
Let's. Here's my recommendation: instead of giving us more choice, give us no choice. Just cash. Just cash in our coins. Don't tell us what we're getting. Push it to our system because you can do that.
Well, I guess that's sort of, you know, like games with gold or whatever is kind of like that, right? I mean, you get four games month and they are what they're
giving
you.
Don't mind that.
We will call it the Juchi of Nintendo reward systems, where you turn on your, what did I get today? Oh, I got this awful Let's Go Buy a Vertical Suspension Train simulator.
You're saying just turn it into
Nintendo.
Pachinko.
I mean, the one thing I will say about the whole kind of, oh, you know, it's stuff we've already bought. With Fire Emblem Fates, when that came out here, as it did come out, you know, a few months later than it did in the States, you know, there was a discount on the, you know, pre-buying the digital version that you could have with gold coins. So that's something. But of course, you know, obviously you'd have to, that doesn't overcome the value disparity between the digital version and the physical version that exists here. That's a pretty fat wedge a lot of the time between buying the digital copy and the physical copy. But if you're someone that wanted digital, you know, because that's how you play your games these days, you know, for convenience, or that you want always on your system to keep going back to and all that, at least you're getting something there, you know, that. You know, that so again, I think when we have more new stuff coming out and they've, you know, got some data about how people are using this service and how much they're pushing people to do their little chores, like find secret symbols on the Zelda website or whatever else they've got in mind, we
track down the Illuminati.
We might see a, you know, a more coherent sort of fully filmed version of this once the next platform rolls around.
Can I ask one question before we wrap this up? I'm looking at the rewards right now, and there's a bunch of Miitomo rewards, and they're all kind of expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that 5 game tickets is 420 smoke it coins, but 10 game tickets is 250? Or maybe that's a tacit slam of me drop. Maybe that's a statement about the quality of the me drop experience. This is obviously not fully there. And I wonder if maybe they wanted it to be better than this when it launched, but they told the investors it was going to come out by this quarter, and damn it, it did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we can't discount that as a possibility. But, yeah, more choice. More choice, or possibly alternate Juchi reality of less choice. You tell me what I'm going to get with my coins.
Oh, you know, if they were just pushing single games, the first one would be Mylon Secret Castle.
Yeah.
You turn on your Wii U and it's on the Wii U and on the Wii mode separately.
All versions, all at once.
I'd zig instead of zagging, and I'd go out and buy a new Nintendo 3DS, and I'd just
and
download
then you,
it.
And when you. No,
download
when you,
it again.
You, When you took it out of the box before it's even been on your Wi-Fi, it's already downloaded.
Yeah.
Hello. Preloaded.
Hello, hello, John. Did you think you would escape the castle that easily? Have you checked every block?
I know you wanted to download me again.
There's no way out.
Bubble, 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 bubble.
I like the idea that just all the shit on the Wii U eShop just getting pushed there and you have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's just Don. We all become Don Koopman.
Mm-hmm.
We all become Don. My Wii U says it won't let me put any more software on this until I delete others, Koopman.
This month, tested with robots.
Every month, tested with robots. And on that, we've tested your patience in this listener mail segment. You could send us your email. To RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. Mike, you have a podcast. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we play video game music, and you're trying
not
to
that video game
it.
Music though. Not directly from the 3DS into your microphone.
No, we already used Mylon Seeking Castle at least once, possibly twice, because I think there was a Game Boy version of that game.
long time ago. That's terrible.
But yeah, we haven't recorded for a while, but there's certainly a bunch of episodes in the archives, and I'm sure we'll get to recording another one soon. It's a lot of fun, and you know we have different hosts on every week, so you can check that out.
Every week,
NintendoWorldReport.com.
Every episode, salvaged. It's fine.
What? I say week again?
You said every week.
Yes, you did.
I started doing that like 15 years ago now or something. Yeah,
it's fine. Everything's fine.
Every week, and my week is like a Jupiter week or something. So
there you go.
Whatever that means. So yeah,
It is a really cool show to be on though. Like it's a fun time, and I am usually a rolling disaster of being able to not guess anything, but that's okay. It's still fun. Also, speaking of plugs. We need your emails. And I already said you could send us your emails with your questions. We also need your emails because it's time for Retroactive. And we're not actually time to do the Retroactive. We're not that far along yet. We are actually in the process of trying to think of what it would be. And we're looking for themes, like a thematic Retroactive. We've done a couple of these. We're going to take your submissions for themes. You can send that to rfn@tendrilreport.com, or you can put it in the comments to the show. We will see them. I was pitching one based on the Power Team cartoon, but we then realized that none of those games are worth playing. So that's
one based on the Hudson games. So
we're
NES
not doing,
games in particular.
We're not doing.
Remember, cue the music again, John.
Didn't you edit the article last week? We are now leading the Hudson boycott because of the very racist Adventure Island.
Yes, yeah, this is true.
So. That's not an option either. What I would say is if you have an idea for a theme, go ahead and email it to us, put it in the comments, and we'll take a look at it. Lastly, we need your suggestions for end music. Music to end the show with. What game and song would you like to hear us sign the show off with? Like
My
this.
I knew it.
Greg, what's our end music? And it's not Mylon's Secret Castle.
It is not Mylon Secret Castle. I don't wish to end the show on a down note, but I did think it was appropriate to mark the fact that this, just shortly after this episode goes out, will be the anniversary of Satoru Iwata's passing. It's hard to believe it was a year ago in some ways. But obviously among his many accomplishments, he pulled out of the fire, from the fires of development hell, Earthbound and Super Smash Bros. Melee, to get them out and working well. And they've become these kind of enduring, there's this enduring affection for those games, which is pretty powerful that we kind of owe to Iwata. So I thought a fitting closing music selection would be the intersection of those two things. So it's the Magikant/8 Melodies theme. From the latest game in the Smash Brothers series for 3DS and Wii U. So enjoy this very, very pretty arrangement of those themes.
Excellent. And that will do it for us this week. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Arrivederci.
Yeah.